Sounds like an exciting topic, how to handle fury. I can hardly wait to find out what I'm going to talk about. Have you heard the phrase, wake up and smell the coffee? Anybody ever heard that? Yeah, every now and then somebody's heard that. I guess you don't have to be a coffee lover to appreciate the smell of coffee, because I'm not a coffee lover and I kind of don't mind the smell of coffee. I don't like the smell of used coffee, but fresh coffee smells pretty good. I like the variation of coffee ice cream. Now, that's not bad. That's pretty good. But I think the idea is there's a good reason to get up, you know, get up and get going. And that's, I assume, part of the idea that's there. So there's a sense in which there is a time to wake up and pay attention to what's going on. I assume that's part of the picture there. And our text today is going to be focusing on that to some degree, because it uses terminology of awake, awaken, wake up, a couple of times in this particular passage. So there are two different exhortations. Right off to start with in verse 9, and then coming up partway through the remaining section. And then there's actually a third time where wake up is referenced, and that's in the next chapter. So you'll see there's a kind of a continuity of focus right there. But there's also two different audiences in view, as in one case, the wake up is focused on one in one direction, the other wake up call is focused in another direction, so we'll want to notice that. But there's a concern that is going to be part of the whole that has a focus on fury. How do you deal with fury? And so that's one of the things we want to think about. So we want to start by jumping right in to the first element that we see here. And that is a call for the Lord to awaken and his response to it. And part of the question is it appropriate for us to ask the Lord to wake up? Well, is he asleep? I don't think so. I think that we have a text that says he neither slumbers nor sleeps. So maybe that's not an appropriate. But that in the mind of some people at times, that seems to be part of the sense, the perception. So we want to take a look at this text here. Beginning at verse 9 through 11, it says, "Awake, awake, put on strength, O arm of the Lord. Awake, as in the ancient days, in the generations of old. Are you not the arm that cut Rahab apart and wounded the serpent? Are you not the one who dried up the sea, the waters of the great deep, that made the depths of the sea a road for the redeemed to cross over? So the ransomed of the Lord shall return and come to Zion with singing, with everlasting joy on their heads. They shall obtain joy and gladness. Sorrow and sighing shall flee away." So there's some element of hope that's communicated in this, and it's looking back on something. And so we see the Lord is urged to respond as in the past. So there are some observations here. The Lord's past actions are remembered. There's a sense in which you can think about how things are in the present that draws us to maybe look back this way for you all, to look back to the past. We often do that, or we should. One of the things I tend to check out pretty regularly in the newspaper is the section on history on page 2. What happened on this date in this year? Because I find it's instructive. It's interesting to see what happened on these occasions. I think, oh, yeah, I forgot about that, or I didn't even know that. And it gives you some perspective. And sometimes you think, oh, I see why people are responding the way they are today because of what happened on another occasion in the past. And so you see there's a connection there, and somewhat that is the case here. Sometimes when we see what's going on now, we ought to ask, what happened in the past to account for where we are today? And in this case, we see the Israelites are seen as communicated through Isaiah speaking here in their behalf, that they cried out for the Lord to act for them. Do something. You've done something in the past. Now do something again. He had worked in their history, but they needed help now. And perhaps it was the believing remnant that was making this request, because perhaps those who are not particularly the believing remnant don't care and don't even think about the Lord, as we can recognize would be comparable to our day. There are many more who don't care about what God has done in the past or the present or if he even exists, compared to those who would be concerned about that. But this call from, as Isaiah is communicating this, to the Lord to wake up, seems to assume that he had not been active in helping the people recently at this time. And so it seems to be suggesting, well, you've done things in the past, but you've been kind of quiet lately, and things have degenerated here, so it looks like you're not really working with us and paying attention. Of course, we can have that same kind of sense when we look at what's going on in our world, in our context, and we say, Lord, what's going on here? We see things are degenerating, and it's not like just a little bit. It's like it's all of a sudden taking a real dive, and things are moving faster than ever before. So we might be inclined to say, wake up, Lord. Hello, do you see what's going on? Smell the coffee. Let me take a look. Are you seeing what's going on here? And he is likely saying, yeah, I do. I'm trying to get your attention. Hello. Which we will see he's going to reference just in a little bit. So, again, it's focusing on the Lord's response, his arm. The reference to the arm usually refers to his actions in the past, something he's done before. But there's something in particular that's referenced here. His arm that's thought of here has to do with his defeat of the Egyptians and Pharaoh and the Exodus in the past. That's the context that's there. And there's a reference to Rahab. Rahab literally means the proud one. Not talking about Rahab associated with Joshua. That was same name but different entity. This is referring to another individual, also referenced in chapter 30, verse 7, and Psalm 87, verse 4. And then there's a reference to dragon, looking also at Ezekiel 29:3, associated with Pharaoh. So the Egyptians and Pharaoh are what are in mind here. But we also need to realize that these references to Rahab and to the dragon were part of the mythological lore of the day. So there would have been familiar terminology, familiar entities that would have been representative, just like we use terms to represent. I mean, you think about Babylon. That's a specific place, but we also use it in a more broad sense. So it would be similar in that same way. So by using these terms, by thinking about this context, it seems to be stressing Yahweh's ability, the Lord's ability to overcome all of the pagan gods and any other power that would be opposing Israel's deliverance or restoration or salvation. In other words, it's saying something about he has exhibited his power in the past in some very significant circumstance. You think about looking back in history and you think about what happened in the Exodus. That was a big deal. It really was a big deal. I mean, we're so familiar with it. You know, it's like, yeah, it was a nice story, but that was major. I mean, you think about the 10 plagues and all that was involved in that, and then the parting of the water to go across and the Egyptians chasing after them and being drowned in the sea and all of that. but it was showing God's power over the perceived powers of the day. And that was pretty significant. That was a major thing. And so it's the thinking here about the Lord drying up the Red Sea and the specific historical context of the Exodus, and the picture that we see more often in the prophets is that analogy is anticipating another kind of deliverance that is yet future, partly associated with the return from exile, but also looking forward to the ultimate, remember the Passover that took place, that was celebrating the deliverance from the angel of death, but also showing faith in the Lord's provision to provide and to save them. Well, there's another Passover coming, and that is the one on which Christ, the Messiah, gives his life. That is a very real context. And all of what came before was anticipating that. So when we see this, we have to be thinking, well, there's something more in the mind of the Lord as he's communicating this, spoken through Isaiah, that we want to keep in mind. So as we think about this context, does the Lord need to be awakened? Well, no, because he's already there, always paying attention. But sometimes we may be in a position where we want to direct the Lord's attention to our specific situation. And while saying, "Wake up, Lord," might be a little strong, we may be saying, "Lord, pay attention," or, "Lord, do you see what's going on here? Lord, do you see my need? Do you see our context?" And in part of the picture that's communicated, it's a poetic language of dependence. It's not probably should be seen as a sign of disrespect, but rather it should be seen as a sign of desperation and a hope that the Lord, if you see what's going on here, you can and will respond. So part of the picture is the Lord's future redemption that's anticipated here. So the consequence of the Lord's arm of providing redemption for the people in the past is sought, desired, hoped for the future as well, with the immediate context, again, of being restored from the Babylonian captivity, which, when you remember Isaiah, when he was speaking, it hadn't happened yet. It's still anticipated, but Isaiah is speaking as though it had happened, and what kind of response are they going to have? Are they going to be responsive to the Lord both now, and will they be in the future when these things do take place? And the picture that's communicated here is suggesting this this context of the restoration from the exile is also a picture, a looking forward, a foretaste of what is going to happen when the true redemption comes to pass. And there's the spiritual aspect of what takes place when the Messiah is sacrificed in our behalf, but there's also the anticipation of their ultimate return to the promised land in the millennial kingdom that is going to be expanded on further in later in the book. So there's a fair amount that's taken into account here, and we see that often in the prophets, Isaiah in particular, where there's a near and a far element to it. And so do we understand the significance of the way the Lord has worked redemptively with his people in the past, and how he's going to be continuing to work in the future and bringing things to culmination? And we probably ought to be thinking, well, do I really appreciate the significance of the redemption that we know we have through Christ now? Do we appreciate that? Do we understand the significance of that. Then, continuing, looking at verses 12 through 14. I, even I, am he who comforts. Who are you that you should be afraid of a man who will die, and of the Son of Man who will be made like grass? Now, this is the response of the Lord. And while the Israelites are shaking in their boots and saying, Lord, wake up, the Lord is coming back and saying, what are you afraid of? Don't you realize who I am? Verse 13, and you forget the Lord your Maker, who stretched out the heavens and laid the foundations of the earth. You have feared continually every day because of the fury of the oppressor. So there's the oppression that they have been experiencing and would experience more in the future. When he has prepared to destroy, and where is the fury of the oppressor? The captive exile hastens, and he may be loosed, that he should not die in the pit, and that his bread should not fail. In other words, there's anticipation of hope and provision yet in the future. So here we see the Lord questions the fearful responses of people, of his people in particular, that he's speaking to through Isaiah at this point. So the people are urged to consider whom they are dealing with. Do you know that you're dealing with the Lord? I mean, you just essentially said, wake up to our situation and act for us as you have in the past. And so the Lord is identifying who he is. He's describing himself as the only true self-existent God. He's the one that would indeed comfort his people, just like had been referenced previously. And he's saying to the Israelites, who are you that you should be afraid of these people, that you should be afraid of the Babylonians or any other human enemy? They're just mortals. The immortal God who is on your side, with whom you are in a covenant relationship with, he will defend you. You don't have to, if we can use the word, freak out. Anytime somebody kind of raises their head around you, opposes you, gets in the way, expresses opposition. Now, that's a good message for us because we're in the same boat. We tend to look at people around us and we fear them. We freak out. We get nervous. And the Lord seems to want to be saying, why? Don't you remember some of these things? If God is for us, who can be against us? Or greater is he that is in us than he that is in the world. And if God is on our side, what do we have to fear from men? I mean, the New Testament gives us plenty of examples of that. The issue is whether we actually believe that he is the Almighty One, the Maker, the one who stretched out the heavens and all of that. Do we recognize that? So the people are urged to reconsider their perspective. We tend to do that very thing. We get focused on the people and the problem, and we forget about the one who is bigger than all of those things. And that was their problem. And so the Israelites had forgotten the type of person Yahweh is as their Maker, the Creator. They don't have to be afraid. Now, that's easy for us to say when we're standing next to a Goliath and we see that we're not sure we can stand up to them. One commentator writes this. He said, to live in fear of humans is to have effectively forgotten God. It is easy to say certain theologically correct things, such as that he is both the world's and our Maker, that he is the one who stretched out the heavens and founded the earth, while giving the lie to those fine words by our continually living as though he can do nothing to prevent humans from doing ultimate harm to us. Yes, oppressors may hurt us, even kill us, but they do not have the power to make us fear or hate them. As just a reminder, keep things in perspective. Do you know who you're dealing with? Are you really a redeemed child of God? I mean, if that's true, if we recognize that, then why don't we accept that? Well, because we're frail, fallen creatures who tremble when the opposition comes toward us. But you think how many times the Lord, through the prophets, had warned the people, don't be afraid of people. Don't be afraid of them. Isaiah had to be told that. Jeremiah had to be told that. Many others, as do we. We have a tendency to fear people and not fear the Lord. It's always turning it around. Say, fear the Lord. Fear the Lord in the right context, proper respect, recognize who you're dealing with, and then you don't have to fear the people. But we still have to deal with them, and therefore we have to have a right perspective. The people are informed of their future release from captivity. This is the hope. This is the encouragement. This is the comfort that is given to them. There will be a freedom of the exiles. They will be able to be released, and they will be able to go about their business. And there's a collective emphasis on here. It's not necessarily saying that no one of them will die in the process of either being taken captive or any of the other matters, but it's a matter of the nation itself. It's more of a corporate idea. The nation will not cease to exist. The Lord is going to provide for them, and they will get their release. They will be able to be returned. We also know that there's a number of the people that will not go with them because they are remaining in unbelief. Only a remnant will respond and actually return when that opportunity comes its way. And we have a similar thing in our age today. How many people really are seeking and trusting the Lord? And how many people are going their own way and doing their own thing? There seems to be a commonality in that. Then Isaiah 51, verses 15 and 16, "But I am the Lord your God, who divided the sea, whose waves roared. The Lord of hosts is his name. And I have put my words in your mouth. I have covered you with the shadow of my hand, that I may plant the heavens, lay the foundations of the earth, and say to Zion, you are my people." Again, he's, because the people are fearful, because they're concerned, he's trying to comfort and encourage them. So the Lord indicates his protective provisions and concern for them, and that happens frequently. I mean, you think about, as we've been through Isaiah, and it's been a little while going through, and there's a lot that's been here, and there is some repetitiveness from time to time, but again, it communicates something of there's judgment coming, but there's hope, there's restoration, there's future, there's comfort, and so those things are communicated pretty regularly. So the Lord reminds his people of his nature and his power. And we need to be reminded of that probably fairly frequently. When things are falling apart, not going the way we think they ought to, what does the Lord want us to do? What did he do with Job when Job was going through so much difficulty and he had more problems than most of us can ever imagine? And what does the Lord say to him? "Job, it's okay. Just relax. Everything's going to be fine." Does he say that? He says, no. "Do you know who you're dealing with? Where were you when I put..." He said, "Focus on who I am. Get a glimpse of who I am." When our world's falling apart, it's not a time for a pity party. It's a time to realize you're dealing with the God of the universe. Take that into consideration. And that's what he's communicating here. Do you know who you're dealing with? And do you know that you have my words? I've given them to you. And he's actually spoken through the people, that is through the prophets, so that the people will have it. So he has had a direct connection in that regard. So again, this is the God of the universe who makes the waves go and all of that. And so you don't have to fear, you don't have to recoil, you don't have to fret, just trust in him. The Lord reminds of his provision and concern for them. And we see that, again, so many times where the Lord says, I'm going to take care of you. I am there for you. I am in relationship with you. I will provide for you. So how is he going to do that? Well, God has spoken to Israel, and he has encouraged them to be the instrument, to be light to the Gentiles, to be trusting in him and all of that. Well, how well did they do with that? Well, not so well. And what is the Lord going to do? Well, he's going to send his servant, and he's referred to Israel as his servant, but he's going to send his servant, the Messiah, who is going to be from and through Israel, and he is going to be representative of them. And it's the words that are going to come through him, the words in his mouth. He is going to be the ultimate one, and his compassionate care is going to be exhibited, as it says, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son. That's going to be part of the picture that's there. And so there's reference here also to the planting of a new heavens and a new earth. There is a spiritual sense that's going to happen through Israel as they go into the millennium, but there's a physical, literal sense that the Messiah is going to bring that into reality, as we see in Revelation 21. There is going to be a new heaven and a new earth. So there's more to it than just one aspect. So as we think about this, it's a reminder to the people that God is concerned. He has a plan. He has things laid out. He's going to restore. He's going to provide for the redemption of his people. They simply need to trust in him. Are they prepared to do that? And he wants his people to be the recipients of his care and concern. But he also wants them to be the instruments through whom this message of hope is communicated to the world, as he does for us as well. Then there's a call to awaken and understand the fury of the Lord, and this is focused on Israel. The first couple of verses here, 17 and 18, awake, awake, stand up, O Jerusalem. Now it's time for you guys to wake up. You who have drunk at the hand of the Lord the cup of fury, you have drunk the dregs of the cup of trembling and drained it out. That's, you've taken it all in. You've been the recipients of the giving out of the Lord's fury, the wrath of the Lord, because of their disobedience, and this was part of their discipline. There is no one to guide her among all the sons she has brought forth, nor is there any who takes her by the hand among all the sons she has brought up. And then continuing the next two verses, 19 and 20. These two things have come to you. Who will be sorry for you? Desolation and destruction, famine and sword? By whom will I comfort you? Your sons have fainted. They lie at the head of all the streets like an antelope in a net. They are full of the fury of the Lord, the rebuke of your God. So he's trying to get their attention for them to realize that you are in the situation that you are in because you have not been living in belief and you have not been obeying the covenant relationship that you are in. That's the essence of it. And he's communicating the serious effects of the Lord's furious discipline. That's what's going on here, and so you need to recognize that you're in that place because of the way you have responded or not responded as you should have. And so here we have the Lord turning the tables on them when they said, "You wake up, Lord." The Lord says, "No, wait, you wake up. I've been awake. I am directing things. You need to pay attention here." And there is a deliverance that is anticipated, but you also need to recognize that you are the recipients of the fury of the Lord because of the way you have responded. There's terminology that's used here, the cup of his fury. And that indicates something of her experiencing punishment for her sins. And if you think back to Mark chapter 10, 38, talks about drinking of this cup and baptized with the baptism with which I am baptized. And there's this recognition of a cup that was associated with a judgment. It was an imagery that was there. You think of Isaiah 29:9. It uses similar terminology. Pause and wonder. Blind yourselves and be blind. They are drunk, but not with wine. They stagger, but not with intoxicating drink. A little bit later on in this section, it uses very similar terminology. Then Isaiah 63:6 says, I have trodden down the peoples in my anger, made them drunk in my fury, and brought down their strength to the earth. Or Psalm 75:8, for in the hand of the Lord there is a cup, and the wine is red, it is fully mixed, and he pours it out. Surely its dregs shall all the wicked of the earth drain and drink down. So again, it's that imagery of judgment. Jeremiah 25:15-16, thus says the Lord God of Israel to me, take this wine cup of fury from my hand and cause all the nations to whom I send you to drink it, and they will drink and stagger and go mad because of the sword that I will send among them. And then Revelation 14:10 is talking to the beast here, or about the beast. He says, he himself shall also drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is poured out full strength into the cup of his indignation. He shall be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. So it's that terminology that's used in various places. And so the picture is that Jerusalem is there laying in a state of stupor and needs to be awakened and arise because the Lord had future plans for her. So even though she's sort of depressed and suppressed by the opposition of the people that are out there that are part of the fury of the Lord that he has unleashed upon them, there is something more that's going to be done that they're going to be a part of, and they need to recognize that. So she shouldn't just stay there in that state of incapacitation because of the judgment. Because it's real easy when we're down. Sometimes we sort of fall apart, and we're sort of stuck in that situation. We become numb or incapacitated, and we can't think straight. We can't function. But this is saying again: look to the Lord. Look to Him. He's the one that you need to come back to. Don't be focused on you and your situation. Recognize, okay, what's the Lord doing here? What is he trying to accomplish? Is he trying to get my attention? Do I need to wake up? Then that's what I need to do. Here we see that she's left in a state of helplessness. As the picture is of being unable to stand up and walk on her own. And the effects of the judgment against her have been so devastating. And she doesn't have the inhabitants to help her along the way, and so she's the ones that would normally have been the strong ones to have been able to help the young men of the land, the sons, the soldiers and whatnot, who have likely been devastated in the process of the destruction of Jerusalem when the Babylonians came on. That's kind of what's in view here. And so she doesn't have that to rely on. And therefore, she's left in a state of discomfort and destruction. So she's hoping for comfort, but she's in a state of desolation. And kind of pictured as being in widowhood or childlessness. And there's no one to mourn for her because she's getting what she had coming because of her disobedience, her lack of responsiveness to the Lord. That's kind of the picture that's communicated here. And what they need to recognize is the Lord is not done. He still has more to do. And you need to rely on him, even in the midst of that situation. Then looking at verses 21 to 23, Therefore, please hear this, you afflicted and drunk, but not with wine. Thus says your Lord, the Lord your God. And there's a difference between, you see, one Lord is not all caps. The other one is. That would be Lord as in master, and then Lord as in Yahweh. And your God, Elohim, would be the equivalent in the Hebrew. He pleads the cause of this people. See, I have taken out of your hand the cup of trembling, the dregs of the cup of my fury. You shall no longer drink it. Well, there's a hopeful thought. Now he's saying that you've gone through this, but it's not going to continue. There's hope. I will put it into the hand of those who afflict you, who have said to you, lie down that we may walk over you. And you have laid your body like the ground and as the street for those who walk over. You've been tread upon significantly. So what we see here is a redistribution of the Lord's furious discipline. The afflicted people are given a word of hope. And there's a transitional statement here, the therefore, and that kind of communicates going from a state of peril to a state of promise. There's hope that's coming. This afflicted nation is now getting a word from the Lord to say it's not going to continue. There's going to be a change here. Israel had suffered the intoxicating effects of the wrath of God, but that's not the end. The Lord's people are not abandoned by their God. The one offering Israel a comforting promise was her master. That's who she needed to look to. And that's where her hope was. It's not looking at herself, her own difficulty, her own situation, though that's what we tend to do, but it's rather look to the Lord in this time, because there is hope, there is provision. So when we see this, we could see it as communicating something that the Israelites are no longer going to experience the outpouring of the wrath of God. Is that true? Well, in this context, that seems to be the case, but yet we know there's times coming when Israel would experience even worse times of persecution. I mean, we think of our own recent history. The Holocaust, the Jewish people. Now, they were not the nation Israel at the time, and we don't necessarily have evidence that that was the outpouring of the wrath of God, but there certainly would have been perhaps lessons they could have learned. But there's also going to be a time coming in the Great Tribulation, the tribulation period, when there's going to be an outpouring of the wrath of God. And so there will be a time when they will experience some of those kinds of things before, as they had before. So they need to recognize that. So it's probably helpful for us to recognize that some of the things that happen in this world are the effects of living in a sinful world and are not the direct consequence of God's judgment, but yet there are times when he indicates when it is. And so there would be times when they would suffer in the future, but their ultimate need has been provided for. There was someone who has suffered in their place, and that is the Messiah, the Christ. And he has made a provision for all, but it requires a responsiveness of receiving that by faith and trusting in him. And that's what they needed to do. And then there's a reminder that the enemies of the Lord's people will be judged. Those who have been a part of the instrument of bringing that fury to the people, they will get their do as well. They will become the recipients of the fury of the Lord. They will drink of the cup of his wrath in the future. And we know that that's the case not only with Babylon, but with the other nations that rise up against the Lord in the tribulation period as well. So all of this communicates that justice will be done. The Lord is not finished. He is bringing things to conclusion. There is hope. They can be encouraged. So how do we deal with the Lord's fury? Well, we need to understand what it is, when it is. We need to recognize it's not the Lord who needs to be awakened. It's us as his people. And we need to take to heart the truth that he is the one who provides. He has provided for our salvation through Christ, and we need to trust in him. And there's an opportunity for us to be obedient to him as our Savior. And we can avoid the fury of the Lord as we trust in him and as we obey him in light of that. And then we can be the instrument that he desires us to be. Just like Israel was intended to be that instrument that was a light to the world, a light to the Gentiles, we can be that light as well. And that should be our desire. And we want to be a part of the Lord's impact for good in the world today.